You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi. How are you? Hi. And welcome. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And before we begin this evening's program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend their respect to all Indigenous peoples today. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you for all being here this evening, if you are a member, and thank you for being here anyway. And if you're not a member, please think about joining. We will see programs like this one if you join, and you will be supporting critical library services and initiatives for children, teens, and adults all over Los Angeles, helping them to improve their lives. It's great to be here this evening for our first summer program with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and novelist Hector Tobar. We will be going out to many branches, not many, but first this weekend we'll be in Studio City with a film program, and then we're having a summer festival in the branch in Pacific Palisades, and in August, for our final summer program, we'll be at the Observatory. And in between, we'll have another program here with this year's National Book winner, Tess Gundy, and the novelist Claire V. Watkins. For more details, go to Aloud at lfla.org/aloud. Now, for what you've been waiting for this exciting program tonight with Hector Tobar and Caribbean Fargoza. By weaving storytelling and reporting and memoir together, Hector Tobar has created Our Migrant Souls, a meditation on race and the meanings and myths of Latino. Tobar elegantly writes about the idea of what Latino is with compassion and vulnerability. As a journalist, educator, son, and mentor, he helps to create a picture for all of what it is and what it is to be Latino in the 21st century in America. The book is a true love letter to those young people who identify as Latino or have been grouped or categorized as one. When interviewed about Our Migrant Souls, Tobar said, quote, "This book was born of a collision of two events in my life. First, being a professor at public university where my classes are often filled with Latinx students, and second, having re-encountered the work of James Baldwin, and especially his fierce book-length essay, The Fire Next Time. Like Baldwin, I wanted to write something that was a declamation, a lament, a poem about the injustices and insults suffered by Latino people, and a celebration of their power and resilience. My earlier nonfiction always began with journalism, with reporting. In Our Migrant Souls, I'm working in a new genre, one with a long and wonderful tradition in the United States, the critical essay. I had many great models in that regard. Eula Biss, Claudia Rankin, W.E.B. Du Bois, Richard Rodriguez, and many others." And, end of quote. And after reading this brilliant book, I can say he will and would make all his predecessors proud. Though it might be a letter to young Latinos, it's a letter to us all, a work that helps us all to understand what race means in America. Please welcome Hector Tobar and Caribbean Fargoza.
All right. Hi, everyone. Good evening. Hi, Hector. Hola. Thank you for joining us this evening. It's wonderful to see people in real life. I don't often get to see a whole crowd of folks coming together because of, you know, the pandemic. So this is a real honor and a real treat. And I'm so honored to have been invited, Hector, to speak with you about your beautiful new book, Our Migrant Souls, a meditation on race and the meanings. Oh, there's more. And myths of Latino. So congratulations on your new book. If we could give him a round of applause for his new book. Thank you. So that was a wonderful introduction to the book, and I was very interested in hearing and in reading in your book that this book came out of the collision of these two specific events. And I wanted to start off with that question. What, if you could tell us more about what prompted this book or how this book was born for you as an idea?
Well, first of all, thanks for agreeing to do this, Caribbean, and you're such a wonderful writer, and I'm just honored that you would be my interlocutor today, and thank you to the Library Foundation for inviting me to what I think is the best literary venue in Los Angeles, so thank you for inviting me. You know, being a professor and teaching a lot of large classes, survey classes, where I basically teach introduction to Latino culture, I get students from this whole incredible cross-section, and I ask them, tell me a story about the Latino experience. That's your final project. You know, nonfiction story, tell me a real story, and I give them some tips on what makes good writing. And I just got all of these incredible stories that were about the pride that people felt in their families and how badass their parents are, you know, and how rich their family lives are, you know, lots of coming out stories mm-hmm. that involve, you know, cultural confusion, and also a lot of hurt, you know, hurt about the way this country sees Latino people, the way the dominant culture treats our people, especially our working people. Mm-hmm. And I just felt the need to speak to that and to give my own sort of shout to these young people who feel the xenophobia, the anti-brown racism that it's so prevalent in the media. You know, it's the one thing you can be openly racist about in this country. And there's a whole cable news network devoted to that. And a whole party whose raison d'etre is that. And so I felt like my students gave me both this vision of the future of American literature, you know, when more of our stories enter the canon of American literature, and also it gave me a window into the hurt that's out there, and I wanted to speak to that with what I knew, which is history and literature, and you know, having interviewed people for 20, 30 years and written about immigration, and then I, thanks to my wife who's a historian, I took this deep dive into American history. And so I wanted to tell my students, you know, this is not an anomaly in American history. We're experiencing something that's directly related to the way this country was built. So that was the general idea.
Yeah, that's great. And I love the introduction so much because you're directly addressing your students, right. All the many students coming from all of these different experiences, all mm-hmm. of these backgrounds from all across Latin America, right. And so that was very, very poignant and, mm-hmm. and beautiful and touching to hear the you that was being addressed over and over. Mm-hmm. And I thought I keep returning to the word meditation.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that. That is could you just tell us more about how you're thinking of this writing as a kind of meditation?
Well, you know, part of it is, and I'll be 100% honest, my editor's only notes to me when I turned in this book, 60,000 words, usually I get like these long memos that are, you know, single space, type 13 pages of notes, and he just told me one thing, and he said, make it feel less like a book of essays. You know, and so that, oh my God, how can I tie these things together? What is unifying all of these pieces that I've written, you know, with these different themes? And so I thought of it as this journey, you know, it's my own journey through American history. American history is amazing. And I have, you know, part of my love of American history comes from my parents. My father especially went to a community college when I was a little boy, and I had his history book. And so since then, I've been a big history buff. And so part of this is this journey through all these different Latino communities, and I actually take a journey through the United States in the book, but also it's this journey through the crazy epic, the violent, creative epic of American history. You know, and so to me, that's the meditation part. It's like, how do we fit in this? You know, it's kind of like a dream. You know, there's all these crazy things in the story, of course. You know, I lived next to James Earl Ray, the assassin of Martin Luther King, and then Booker Wade, this African-American civil rights activist, ended up being my godfather, met my mother, you know, in an apartment building in Hollywood, gave her a ride to the hospital when she was pregnant. So it's just like, it's this, for me, it's like this kind of dream journey through American history and through the different aspects of Latinidad.
Yeah, it did feel like a dream that was at times exquisite and beautiful, and then sometimes just devastating, and sometimes a nightmare.
Absolutely.
And another reason I thought the meditation is such a great way to think of this is because when I think of meditation, for those of you who meditate, it's about how you focus your attention, right? And being aware of your surroundings. And sometimes the awareness is vast, and sometimes it's very, very specific and just focused on one little thing. And I thought your book was beautiful in that sense, that there was the background of history, and not just a background, just present, the vastness of history of centuries, present in everyday life. And then sometimes you would just focus in on just very specific little moments, very specific objects and intimacies in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you write fiction, and you're writing a novel now, and I've written novels. And there's a space, headspace you get in when you create a novel, because a novel is about, usually about, you know, a handful of people or one person and their passions. And so you get into that person's dream spaces. And absolutely, I think that I was really lucky. I had a year off from work. I was a Harvard fellow for online a year. So I went to Harvard online for a year. And just to be able to think about all these people I met, you know, and also to be older, you know, we both have families. My three are all in college or graduated from college. And so it's this moment of reflection, you know, you think of, because this country is really made up of millions of people who've undertaken these family journeys, you know? And I think the Latino family journey is the least well-known of them all, you know, because of the way our people are marginalized in the media. There aren't, you know, 12-part Netflix epics about a family from San Antonio living on both sides of the border. You know, that just isn't part of the regular consciousness of the American people. We have playwrights, but they're not celebrated like Henry Miller, you know? I mean, excuse me, like Arthur Miller or like, you know, Harold Pinter, you know? We have great novelists, but their work isn't celebrated. It's not part of the country's knowledge of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and throughout the book, you talk about people that you meet on buses or on the street or on various trips that you've taken all across the country or with your students, and there's often this moment that happens when you talk about history with this person, and there's kind of like this shift in awareness that happens when they understand their connection to history. And I can see how that would shift anybody's awareness to really see that clear connection between oneself and events that are happening in the world. Can you speak more about how important it is to see, at least from your experience in talking to people, to connect oneself to the trajectories of history?
Well, absolutely. I think most people are hungry to understand their lives that way. Mm. And I find I like when my subjects go into these philosophical places. And they always do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like my novels are filled with Latino intellectuals because I know so many Latino intellectuals, starting with my parents. You know, people who weren't able to fulfill their education but have read their whole lives, mm-hmm. have always been these consumers of culture. And so in my book, you know, I went and I traveled across the country and I met this guy in Atlanta who's undocumented, construction worker, you know, in his 30s. He was a poet. And he was dying to speak to someone who would treat him like a poet, like the poet he was. And so when we got into that groove, you know, it was hard to pull myself away. And that just, I think that happens to me again and again. And, you know, I went to Miami and I had like 2 or 3 hours in Little Havana. And I ran into these seniors who were trying to get their visas. And they just told me this incredible epic story of their family life. And they were not, you know, they were very anti-Castro. But they also were kind of anti-capitalism, mm-hmm. which was like, whoa. I mean, if you listen to people long enough, they will defy a stereotype. Mm. You know, most people do. And I think as writers, what's interesting to me is when someone steps away from the stereotype. I tell this to my writing students. You know, surprise is the essence of constructing a memorable character. And to me as an interviewer, I interviewed people for the LA Times 25 years, literally thousands of people. I was almost always surprised. I go to New York and I didn't have time to interview that many people, but I met this guy who was an expert. He was a former utility worker who knew the entire history of El Barrio. He was a total radical from like the 60s. So yes, I gravitate towards those kind of people, but I think most of us do. I mean, you and Romeo, your work in this, you know, South El Monte Arts Posse, that's exactly what you're doing. You're gravitating towards people who have this hunger to have their history recognized, who understand themselves, and I think most Latino people understand themselves as part of this epic story. You know, we have border crossers and revolutions in our background and coup d'etat, you know, and all kinds of crazy history. Yeah. You know, Mexican-American people have pachucos and, you know, repatriation and all this incredible stuff. And you know, and so, yes, absolutely. I drift towards that kind of person.
Yeah, and I totally agree that for students, for all people, but it's definitely a thing that occurs with younger people, with students, with college students and high school students, when they see that moment where they realize that they're born within history, that they're not ahistorical beings that just blossomed out of the ground. I mean, they can be creatures of nature, but they're also part of these things in the world that matter. And I could see how that would be a great way to people to tell stories orally, but also written through various writing exercises. And have you found that students are generally willing to go down that path?
Yeah, absolutely, especially once you show them some examples. Mm. So what I do when I teach writing classes, survey classes that are about as big as the audience here. They're about 100 people or more. And so I give a little lecture on writing and I show them previous examples. Like, you know, I have a great one I use of a student, you know, growing up in the Central Valley and how he and his buddies had a whole bunch of friends and one of them was a rooster. You know, and they had this gang, there was their gang and their gang was 4 guys and a rooster and they always hung out together. And it was like, whoa, I could never make that up, you know. Mm-hmm. Another kid who said, you have no idea what it's like, and the voice is wonderful, to be a kid who is an emo kid who lives with literal mariachis. And who's surrounded by these men with tight pants. You know, it's like, and so once they get the, you know, once like, see, you can go here, you can do this. And then it just becomes a flood. And I ask them about nicknames. Who here has somebody who knows, has a relative with a nickname? And then all the hands go up, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's, I get a lot of responses, absolutely. And a lot of them are in the book.
Yeah, yes, totally. And I love that note about the emo, growing up emo among mariachis. I mean, how more emo can you get with mariachi? It's like tragedy and love and
absolutely.
Weeping and melancholy, which is something that I wanted to talk to you about.
Oh,
like
yes.
The presence of melancholy, I found it so notable throughout the entire book. And I mean, aside from melancholy, it felt like a very emotional book. And I think I read in one of your Facebook posts that people have read and wept in reading these personal anecdotes, these personal stories, and I can see why. But I was interested in hearing from you about just like your approach to this, like what reads to me as a very emotional, complex landscape that is infused with the glorious things and aspects of life, but also like melancholy that seemed kind of pervasive to me throughout. I don't know how you experience it.
No, absolutely. You know, one of the things I discovered when I was writing this book is that the words melanin and melancholy have the same root. So melanin is what makes us darker, right? It's what's in the pigment in the skin. And melancholy, of course, is a sadness. And they both come from the Greek root, word melas, which means black or dark, right? So melancholy is this darkening of the soul. And that's, yes, I think that it's very much, it's one of the main threads in this experience that ties us all together as Latino people. Latino people are really diverse. You can have been here four or five generations as Mexican Americans, as my wife's family is. They're Mexican Americans here for several generations, at least one side of her family is. Or you can be more recently arrived like my family, or you can be like in a mixed status family. But you have this journey that defines your existence. You know, it's almost like the Jews, right? The Jews are 3,000 years removed from the Exodus from Egypt, and yet they, every Passover, they commemorate it. And that's what being Latino is. It means that you have this separation in your past. And for, you know, for many of us who are first or second generation immigrants, that's a real big wound. You know, I mean, I grew up separated from my extended family. You know, and now, as you know, I mean, many people of our students' generation, they can't go back. They've never seen their extended families, or they experience family funerals on FaceTime because the family can't go back. So that's definitely, I think, something that's there. And I think what's not acknowledged about it is that we're also fighting back against it all the time. You know, it's how do I continue? And I find a way to continue. And that's, to me, the most beautiful thing about it, you know? And, you know, it's like, it's a sad poem, but from sad poems, there's also this sort of strength that comes through. I will survive. Mm-hmm. And those two things together really, you know, like the woman in the book who says, she has to say goodbye to her family because her mother is dying and she's going back to Mexico. And her son is like breaking up at the airport. He's ready to cry because he doesn't know when he's going to see his mother again. And she tells him, you know, no te quiebras, don't break. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, so strong, you know? Yeah. So I think that within this story of us and the wall and the border, there is this amazing strength. And that, I believe, is the story that isn't told enough about us.
Right. And I definitely saw both, that strength that just propelled people to work and to not just work, but also to bring beauty into the home through literature. I mean, several of my favorite moments in the book were those scenes where you illustrate a family reading together or a child reading in the living room. And there's even a beautiful scene of you as a child reading in your living room. And I don't know, those were the most touching, I think, for me. Certainly the heartbreak, because I know about that feeling of being separated from family by the border, but then also the beauty and I don't know, the glory of being like a young person growing up surrounded by hopefully these resources. And you talk about LACMA and the experience of going to LACMA
as
a young person.
Yes. Places so, like this, like yeah. the public library.
Yeah, you know? Where people can walk in for free and
right.
enjoy these things. And I guess that's one of the blessings of living in Southern California and LA County specifically, that we have access to things like this. Another thing that I wanted to ask you, a thing that I noticed when I was reading is I felt like I could see many Hector Tobars, several Hector Tobars at work, very busy in this. I saw the professor, I saw the journalist, I saw the fiction writer, and I saw the person, the father, the son, the person of the family. And I was curious to hear you talk about maybe how you managed all the Tobars together to make this book happen.
Well, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that a lot of my family are here tonight, including my mother, Mercedes, and my father, Hector. Is he here? Yes, they're here. Together, the first time It's the first time they've been at one of my events together in ever. So thank you for both being here. Yeah, I think that, you know, I was an only child, so I didn't really have many social skills when I was younger, especially when I was first starting out in writing. I don't think I had that sort of emotional intelligence and depth of vision of the human experience that I have now, many years later, after being a father and a husband for 30 years, you know? So there's that. And yes, I think that as you become older as a writer, you just pick up all these different instruments that you could play, you know? And it's like, you've done journalism also. You do a lot of journalism, do essays, and you write fiction. And so I think it's wonderful. This project was wonderful in the sense, for me as a writer, in the sense that it gave me opportunity to do all these different kinds of writing. And to also talk a little bit about my family, you know, because my family is this really unique journey through Latinidad, because I'm Guatemalteco. My companion Virginia is Mexican American Chicana, so our kids are Mexican American Chicano Guatemalteco Angelinos, or just Latino for short, you know. And so all of that, you know, it was. Although I didn't talk too much about my kids because I figure I would leave that for them to tell one day their own journeys through ethnic and racial and class identity, because it has been a journey.
Yeah. So it definitely was fascinating to see you using these different tools and these different approaches that you've mastered and honed and worked very craftfully over the years, many years as a journalist and as a fiction writer also. An interesting moment for me in reading was, just the story of how James Earl Ray was your neighbor, basically, right? And he went off to commit this horrendous act. You know, he murdered Martin Luther King Jr. and happened to be your neighbors. And that's just kind of mind-blowing. But you do this thing that really caught my attention where it seemed like you were sort of speculating as to maybe what he was thinking. I felt like we got this really interesting interior view of this criminal mind, and you did research about his background, where he came from, his own migration to Los Angeles, how he grew up a very poor person in this dysfunctional family. But you were sort of creating this interior life for us to read, and I thought, there's the fiction writer at work there. And I was curious to hear from you how you sort of manage that, like using this tool of fiction to sort of speculate, and just in general, I guess, how these tools of fiction maybe contribute to your work of nonfiction.
Yeah, I think that the main tool that you have as a fiction writer is empathy. You know, is entering the point of view of everybody and recognizing the humanity of everyone, even the person who commits this absolutely horrific act. And it was, you know, reading his life, I just saw so many commonalities with my own family life. I mean, they were very, very poor, the race. But they were even poorer than I think anyone in my family ever was. They were like, smells like pee, covered in dirt, poor, you know, living, taking apart the cardboard walls in the winter to burn, to stay warm, poor. But more than anything, the reason why I stayed with Ray I tried to get into his head was because that was my entry into whiteness. So all of these racial categories we have in our country, you know, and Latino's not supposed to be a race category, but it's treated like one, right? So there's black suspects, white suspects, and Latino suspects, even though there's, you know. And so he was my entry into the pain of whiteness. So Latino and racist ideas about brown people are created as this counterpoint to white, just like black was. And so I wanted to speak about the pain and the hurt that and the insecurities that created these categories, and how me living in this world next to a racist is because of the society that manipulates our emotions and puts them into these channels. And he believed fervently in white supremacy because that was a way of affirming his own humanity in a world that had treated him, in his eyes, you know, like shit. Excuse me, you know? And so, you know, and that just led to a whole sort of can of worms because, you know, Latinos, we were supposed to be white. And a lot of us have, like, you know, my parents on my birth certificate are listed as Caucasian because they couldn't fit people into the race scheme any other way. And so to me, that was interesting to talk about. There's lots of colorism in our families. There are these ideas that lighter skinned people are smarter. You're a lighter skinned Mexicano, you're smarter than a darker skinned one, right? So that was part of that. That's also what was going on there, was me trying to think my way through these ideas of race. Mm-hmm. And Ray presented that opportunity.
Yeah. It's just such an ambitious project. I mean, just to think of, it just seems daunting to think of the task of unpacking the meanings of race is so, I mean, and especially for Latinos, as you said, it's not supposed to be treated as a race, but it is. And we come to the United States, so many of us that migrated here, our parents who did, with ideas about, our own ideas about race and our own colorisms. And I kept thinking about the castas, which yes. You talk about, it's like a caste system that was already put in place and enforced since colonial times, right? Where if a mulata married a white person, then it was like a morisco. And it was very elaborate to the point of absurdity. Absolutely. But it was like a real far-fetched effort to categorize and create a strict hierarchy of power. And we already come with that to the United States. And then there's this other additional hierarchy of power that we're constantly juggling and being placed within and placing ourselves and each other with. So I just commend you for that huge the effort in doing that. Did it ever feel like very daunting, or how did it feel
to you?
I
was just like, I felt like I was learning something, you know, every time I read Cheryl Harris's wonderful essay, Whiteness as Property, mm-hmm. you know, which was like, oh my God, you know, that was like such an education. May and Guy's book, Impossible Subjects, which is basically about how the immigration laws have reflected different race ideas over time, including racism against Jewish people and Southern European people, et cetera, et cetera. And then, and then it got really close to home because I realized that this happens with us and indigeneity.
Right.
And the way in which we've learned, our families have erased our indigeneity. I had the chance when, you know, I was in my late 20s of interviewing two of my grandparents who were both very indigenous presenting, I guess we would say now, right? My mother's father and my father's mother, both from very indigenous regions of Guatemala. What are we? You know, what is our indigenous heritage? No, somos españoles. We're Spanish. And then I learned from my uncle who is also very, my Uncle Tono, very indigenous presenting, about how it works now and the discrimination against indigenous looking people in his bank, he would tell me, how people, when they can, they lose their old their indigenous last names and adopt Spanish last names. And my partner, Virginia, had done an oral history with the great leader, Gloria Arenas,
yes.
who is Tongva, discovered late in life. Not until she was middle-aged did she discover that she's Tongva, because it had been erased from her family. And so this, you know, we have this race drama, right? And it's like, but there aren't really any movies made about it that I know of, you know? It's not because there are movies about the, you know, the so-called mulatto race drama, excuse me for using that archaic term, right? And there's the tragic mulatto. And you see these movies from the 1930s and 40s. That, you know, there could be easily a movie made about the tragic mestizo, because it's supposed to be this tragic thing that you're, you know, you're the product of this indigenous and this white mixture, and it's a sad thing, and everybody wants to forget about it or not talk about it. Usually, the erasing of indigeneity is tied with these ideas of legitimacy, you know, and it's like, wow. So Guatemala, where I've learned a lot about this, it's just really a really interesting history that is completely not presented to us or studied.
You've mentioned several times about what might be an interesting or not an interesting Netflix series or a film that we might want to see about, like, some drama in the family where you discover, heaven forbid, that you're indigenous or whatever. Like, these stories, as I was reading, I kept thinking, like, so what would be an interesting story, or what stories are missing? And I guess the issue of representation, or the question of representation in media, especially in popular media like film and television, was something that I think kept popping up for me as I was reading this. And I guess I was just wondering, I'm not even sure what the question is, but just what do you think is the power there of telling our stories in film and television or popular media?
Right. Well, I think that a lot of Latino people, if I use that term, or Latinx people, grow up with the sense that they're broken. There's something wrong with us. You know, oh, my family, you know, my father, he crossed, and, you know, he had another family. And, you know, they just have all these sense of, like, oh, my, you know, my mother, she drank too much, you know, whatever. And they have this sense of, like, that we're broken. And that we're, and that part, there's something fundamentally broken about us because we had to migrate, and we left all this behind, and part of it is that we haven't seen that story represented on stage and screen. You know, I mean, we're not seeing that. We're not seeing. You know, there are independent films and great theater, but it's not part of the, you know, the mass produced. What do we get instead? What do most Latino actors, male actors, get work playing? Mm-hmm. Sicarios, you know, cartel operatives, mm-hmm. gang members. Mm-hmm. That's who we represent. It's like, it's just maddening. There are so many great Latino actors who are playing cartel operatives and doing a great job at it, by the way, and, you know, bringing all this complexity and depth to the, you know, to the murderer, mm-hmm. you know, but that, you know, it just really, it causes social harm. I really believe it causes social harm. Because, you know, when you, if you are coming out in a Latino family and you have read four or five other great coming out stories, and of course now there's starting to, you know, there's all this great YA fiction, it helps to know that you're not the only one with a crazy mother who reads your journal. Mm-hmm. You know, which is like a story that one of my students told, you know, it's like, you know, her mother so excited that she had this girlfriend over and didn't realize what was going on until, like, you know, 4 or 5 months later when she opened, you know, got the, you know, that kind of thing. And all of the, just the drama of it and people feeling that. And then just, like, I can't tell you how many times people have described the moment of coming out and all the tears that have been shed because of all the weight of the, you know, of the culture on them and these, you know, these very conservative ideas about family and gender and whatnot. So I think it would just make people's lives a little bit easier.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that you chose to, I don't know, think about, like, utopia. Like, what is the future? What would be, like, a utopia for us? And folded with queerness and how queer folks and non-binary folks imagine a future where they are free, but where we are all free. And could you say a little bit more about utopia and, I don't know, how you see, like, maybe Latinx, Latino queerness fitting into that?
Yeah, I think that queer activists are just one of many people who are questioning the emotional and cultural foundation of a society of exploitation. So we live in a society, for me, and this is, I mean, for me, part of just presenting the idea of utopia is really presenting the idea of a critique of our society that goes beyond just race, right? To me, race is at the service of exploitation. So Black, Mexican as a race category, you know, Mexican was a race category in the census in 1930, right? So Mexican as a race idea, like, you dirty Mexican, right? Black, all, you know, even, you know, Chinaman, et cetera, those ideas are created at the service of the system of labor exploitation. And so to me, imagine a world, you can't just say, I'll give everybody a pill and erase the racist ideas from their head and we'll all be great. No, because inequality would produce new ideas of of race. You know, race is this idea that everyone who's in this particular group, they act that way. They're homeless, for example, because there's something wrong with them in the way they are as people. And so our attitudes towards people who live on the streets, it's kind of like a proto-racism, right? We're kind of, you know, we're saying that's the way that they are. They're, you know, et cetera. So to me, bringing up utopias is a way of saying we need theories about the present that imagine another world so that we can critique this one. And it was just wonderful to, I mean, for me, this was a very late discovery in the process of writing this book, is listening to and reading these Latinx queer historians and critical thinkers. That was just wonderful. And then, you know, part of it too is that drag, for example, is this performance of defiance and this performance as a critique of gender roles. And to me, that's the Black Panthers too, you know, and the brown, and the brown berets. It's this performance that's a critique of the system. And say, this system, this place that we live isn't good enough for us. It isn't fair enough. There isn't enough love for us in this society. We need to imagine another one. So to me, I didn't want to get overly political, but I wanted us to get to that space because that's really, to me, what I want the next generation to do. I want them to have these theories of change that involve everything, gender, race, class. I think that's really the big thing that we don't talk about in this country is social class, you know? And Latino is in many ways synonymous with working class, right? To a lot of people. So that's where I was headed. You know, it was trying to embrace the curiosity and the creativity of the generations to come.
This book feels very appropriate to the moment. And I wonder what you think you would want this book to communicate to someone who's just walking into a bookstore, picking up the book. Like, what is it that you want them to carry off from having read your book?
That they should tell a friend about it and have them buy two more books.
Yeah.
I think that part of it, there's lots of answers to that question. It's like, I think that's the one other way of thinking about that is who do I imagine my readers to be, you know, or the readers to be? And part of it is just, I just wanted to write something that my students could read and just feel like, oh, that makes sense. I should read some more, you know? And sort of like to bring them into this like meditative state of being readers and thinkers, which they already are, but just sort of telling them, you know, we belong in this space too. And the other thing is just for me is understanding how race, the ideas of race hurt all of us, not just Black and brown people, but also white people. Right? Because white is this, and I talk about this in my book when I talk about James Earl Ray, it's supposed to be this state of erasure. It's the state of erasure. No human being is really white. It's this state of mind that we create in which we erase the pain of an ethnic past, the pain of a journey, and we think of ourselves as consumers, you know, as actors in this society, this meritocracy, everybody has the same opportunity. And that's actually a really cruel way of thinking. It's a very, because to erase yourself from your past and to be embarrassed, you know, it's like, you know, many times I've done these interviews and then the person interviewed me says, well, yeah, now that you mention it, and they'll mention all of their different ancestors, you know, Irish and Jewish and all these different, you know, and it's like, we don't fit in these categories. Latino, we don't fit in one name. Latino erases our indigeneity, erases our Africanness. It says that we're Latin, Hispanic, right? So I think that I really believe that that's part of where our national conversation should go and that we'll build stronger alliances that way.
We can open it up to questions. I feel the energy. Somebody is already raising their hand here. We'll have someone pass the mic over to you, and you can
thank you.
Go ahead and ask.
Thank you, Mr. Tovar. You write both short fiction and novels, and I'm wondering if there are topics that are better handled in one format or over the other, or do you just sit down and simply start writing and find out you're writing a short story?
That's a really great question. I think that pretty much, well, with my last novel, I originally set out to write it as a nonfiction book, and I realized it would be a better novel because I needed to get into the motivations of the person who was in the story, Joe Sanderson, this quote-unquote white guy who became a revolutionary in El Salvador. I just think, the only difference for me between the two is that when I write nonfiction, and I write a book that I know is going to be sold as nonfiction, that I can't make stuff up. But, you know, it doesn't mean I can't use my imagination. It's just I have to be honest about it. You know, I have to be honest with the reader that I don't know what this person was thinking, but I can kind of guess. And so to me, the two genres are not that different, except that, of course, with fiction, oh my God, you can really do just about anything. I mean, you can you can jump 500 years in the future. You can become a bird in a work of fiction. You could do that too in nonfiction, but you have to tell the reader, you know, if I were a bird, you know. So I really don't see them as being that much different, to tell you the truth. But thank you for asking. Thank you.
Hello. Another question about writing, actually. I've read the book. I thought it was absolutely fantastic and beautiful to read. And one of the things that I found really interesting about it, as someone who has sort of comes at this, you know, I'm not American, I don't know a lot about the Latino community. One of the things that really struck me and shocked me was my indignation at the sort of truth that you were revealing in your book. You know, the whole idea of these Latino community, the people that we see here in LA as gardeners and cooks and whatever, and that their kind of history is erased in the service of whiteness, as you put it, it made me really angry. And one of the things that I found fascinating about the book was that you maintained, in a weird way, this kind of anger at the same time as being beautifully lyrical. And I just wondered how the hell you did that.
Well, I think that part of it is avoiding cliche and avoiding language that creates barriers. And as a novelist, you know, when you write fiction, you really are in touch with, you want your prose to always feel new. So I didn't want to go into a space, into the really safe and easy space of being just outraged. You know, and I think that part of it is always, what is really always questioning your assumptions. So I liked critiquing the cartel movies, but I also liked, oh, wait a second, now that I think about this, this really is about white insecurities and sort of decoding the way these cartel movies worked. And it was, I like just taking things apart and showing people what I'm learning. So I think part of it is respecting the intelligence of the reader and saying, I'm not gonna just appeal, I know you're not just reading me because you agree with me. You're reading me because you love language and you love humanity, you know? And I want to pursue that as intelligently as I can. And so I think that's, and I'm so grateful. Thank you. That's the one of the best compliments I've ever had from any reader ever in 25 years of doing this. So thank you for that. But I want to keep you off balance as a reader. I don't want you ever to think, oh, I know what he's going to do next. You know. So thank you.
Was first.
Gracias.
Gracias.
Vos sabes más o menos quién soy yo. Me llamo Gonzalo, es mi primer nombre. Javier es mi apellido. Soy puro chapín. Nací en la capital. Pero antes de seguir hablando a vos, hasta oírse al siguiente, me hiciste llorar desde la primera página.
Ay, gracias. Perdón, pero gracias.
Mira, voy a tener que decirlo en inglés. Parte nada más. Uh-huh. He made me cry from the first page I read his book. And believe me, I know something about that pain. I'm an 84-year-old man.
I think I want to, in answer to your question, to your remarks, I want to acknowledge my mother and father, and especially because I was thinking about how I became a writer. And part of it is just loving yourself and where your people, and having this sense of like that we should be respected. And I think that my mother especially, always raised me with a sense that I was worthy, that I was the product of love. And my father always raised me to think that I was a special, intelligent person. So I think that part of my indignation and part of my making you cry comes from the realization that so many of our people are treated with disrespect and wanting to sort of be in that space of our humanity. So thank you for saying that. Thank you. Gracias. Muchas gracias. De un chapín a otro.
Hi, Héctor. Hello.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
¿Qué tal? My question has to do with your choice of language. I mean, I'm wondering, just you grew up bilingual, first language is Spanish, my first language is Spanish. Do you see your novels when they get translated or whatever? I'm curious as to how they come across in Spanish versus English. I mean, I know when I read, at times I will always gravitate towards the Spanish versus reading the English translation of the Spanish novel, just because me nace más, me llega más. You know, it's just more emotional. I'm wondering for you as a writer that can manage both languages, if you started just writing in English because that's the dominant culture, or if you have thought about exercising that part of your creativity in your brain to write in Spanish?
Well, thank you. It's a great question. First of all, my novels especially, and this book too, has a lot of untranslated Spanish. And that's thanks in part, well, in large measure, to my editor, Sean McDonald, white guy from Laguna Hills. also, Juno Diaz's editor of Oscar Wilde. And he told me, "Heck, you don't have to translate. You don't have to be translating all the time. Just let it go. It kind of looks kind of silly when you're always translating. You know, everybody knows what, muy bien means. You know, whatever. You know." And that was like, wow, I can do that. Of course, Nabokov has all this untranslated French. Why can't I have untranslated Spanish? And so there was that. And of course, that became like this whole door opening to the linguistic arsenal in my head. I grew up, my first words were almost certainly in Spanish. My mother informed me a couple days ago that my first words were Coca-Cola, which I didn't know. But when I went to school, I never learned to read and write in Spanish until I got to college. So English has always been the language, my primary language of writing, always been my primary language of writing. And I remember writing for the first time for a publication in Spanish, where I became the editor of a bilingual newspaper. And I translated my own work into Spanish. I wouldn't be able to do that now because my Spanish, I'm not as confident in it as I used to be. Now, as far as my books being translated, only one of my six books has been translated into Spanish. And a lot of that has to do with the politics, the business of Spanish book publishing, and its control basically by these Madrid, Spanish conglomerates. And basically, I think my books are just too intellectual for them. they're trying to find, because my publisher bought the Spanish rights, and he goes, well, the way it works is we need to find a Spanish publisher, but we're having a little bit of trouble. And it's because they don't see us as intellectual readers, the market as intellectual. And so, that's just the truth. But I absolutely adore dropping Spanish and into my books, and it's part of my linguistic arsenal. And I think thank you for asking. Thank you.
Hey, Hector.
Hey, hola,
how are you?
Hey, años.
Yeah, I know. Congratulations. It's just a privilege to hear you and that you've been so successful in your writing. I had a question in terms of the idea of the Spanish invasion planting the seed of racism, you know, 1519, that connection to 1619, the connection really to the Chinese Exclusionary Act, you know, 1885, how all of that kind of embeds this racism in our system and throughout. And I'm curious as to like how, if feels like every single institution, whatever it is, you have to deal with it. So I'm curious about the publishing industry in terms of like getting an agent, getting a publisher, you know, because our stories aren't told. Much of it is because there's this institutional racism that doesn't feel like our stories are American stories, universal stories, and our humanity is not shown.
Right.
So I'm just curious if you could just speak to that, because you somehow have been able to break through. You have a book. It's published. There are plenty of stories here that we need to hear. You know, like your story, we need to hear your story, and we haven't we have not heard your story, and there's good reason for it.
Thank you for your question. I've been really lucky. I've had some powerful allies. You know, publishing also is a relatively, how should I put it? It's like the quaintest corner of the capitalist system. You know, the money involved, at least in literary works, isn't always that huge. But I've just been really, my original agent was the great Virginia Barber, who was an agent to Alice Munro, who won the Nobel Prize, among others. Really wonderful woman, bought, you know, sold my book, The Tattooed Soldier, for $5,000 to a small house, got my literary career started. And ever since, all my other books have been represented by Jay Mandel, who I now consider a friend, and there's at least one other writer here who's one of his clients. And someone who's never, he takes my calls and represents my books, even though every one is different from the one before. You know, I mean, my last novel was about a white guy. You know, it's like, some people are like, what are you doing that for? Why are you writing this book? And Jay never said anything. You know, he just like, this is what you're working on and we'll try to sell it, you know? And I've just been very, very fortunate. My editor, Sean McDonald, has championed Latino writers, including Juno Diaz, among others. My friend Obed Silva is another one of his writers, who's got a great book, The Death of My Father, the Pope, an incredible memoir, which I highly recommend. Been out about a year or so. So I've been really, really fortunate. And I think, but part of it too is recognizing when you get bad advice, when you get people telling you that you're making the wrong decision. Why are you quitting the LA Times, Hector? That's a ridiculous decision. You know, I quit the LA Times to get an MFA. I mean, I think it's really I've been rewarded for taking bold and unconventional decisions, you know, and so I've been really fortunate, and also to have a family that has supported me through these decisions, you know, supported me through, you know, a decade of not publishing a novel and all the, you know, depression that was present in my house. Sorry, family, kids, you know, for that. So I've been really fortunate. But I think, you know, a lot of it is, I think we have allies and we have to seek them out, and we also have to stick to our guns.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you. Your book is really, really great. I appreciate it. And both as a student and as a person of color. I wanted to ask you, you were speaking about the erasure and the erasure of indigeneity and the importance of people knowing about it, the true history and what happened, right, or what's still going on. And as a professor and somebody who's, you know, definitely respected in the community and academia, even for folks who probably are not part of academia. You talk about gangs and neighborhoods, right? So people look to you as a scholar, as a leader. And I wonder if it would be more educational or as a form of resistance in a way to fight back against that erasure to encourage people not to use Latino if they feel, until they fully understand. As you even mentioned, there's people who, a friend of yours who said they didn't discover they were Native American until way late in life, right? And I don't like even using that word American with Native because, again, that's part of the erasure, assimilation, and marginalization. So I ask if you think it would be encouraging people to not use it and to more give more education and historical perspective in regards to that erasure. Thank you.
Well, yeah, that's why I put the word Latino in quotes in my book, on the cover, in the title, because it is inadequate. But all the terms are inadequate. All the terms are, I like to think of them as coloring book kind of things, you know? Latino is useful, and Latinx are useful in the terms of the expressive alliance. They express an alliance, right? I'm Central American, you're Mexican American, right? We're on a stage together. This is a Latino literary space now, right? So I think it's useful. I absolutely, I think my whole book is an attempt to deconstruct what's, you know, how these terms are put together. And I'm very excited that we have a debate about our missing indigeneity, but one that's just not about terms, because it's really easy just to make it a question about a term. It's more than that. It's a question of like exploring how these ideas have been constructed, how our families, why did our families erase them? How did this, you know, it's something that I think is really requires a deep dive. And so the term is just the beginning of it. Absolutely. So thank you. Thank you.
Hola, Hector.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Oh, I'm sorry. Ana María, and una chapina también. What would you say to a young high school students if they're pursuing a writer career? They already wrote something, but they're afraid. They don't feel confident. How should they approach? How should they look for mentors?
I think, first of all, there's so much to say. I think, first of all, you have to believe in the importance, the power of your vision as a young person. And I would say this to every young artist that I know. You have to really believe you have something to say that no one else can say. And that's really, really important. Number two, I think it's really important to study your craft, whatever that is. If you're going to be a writer, if you're going to be a painter, if you're going to be an illustrator, if you're going to be a journalist, you know, each one of those things is a craft many centuries in the making. And it's important to study it. And you can study it in so many different ways. You can sign up for a university class. You know, when I was a journalist and wanted to write fiction, I took classes at UCLA Extension. You know, and a Beyond Baroque, because I respected the idea of the craft. And I think, and also, the most important thing is to have patience and to not surrender and to realize that every moment of rejection is going to make you stronger. And if you don't ever suffer any rejection as an artist, it probably means you weren't trying hard enough to do something really crazy. And in doing that crazy thing, that's really where genius is, you know? So and I can also tell you that as someone who has mentored people and witnessed the careers of people, that it's not always the brilliant ones who have the careers, you know. It's not like we're born with this like, you know, like vision and brilliance. No, it's like hard work. It's like believing in something. I mean, I look at the poetry that I wrote when I was 19, those stories that I wrote when I was in my early 20s. Ugh, that's another person, you know? And I just stuck with it long enough, you know? And it's just like being, just loving it, finding that one thing, that one craft that you love and you see that you're just willing to read everything or study everything about that particular craft. That's, you know, and that it's going to be really important, because I think it's important that young people know that they are the future by definition, and that we need their works of art. You know, we need their craft, we need their passion, we need their anger, we need their frustration. You know, we need that. We need them to hurt so they can make these great works of art for us. So that's what I say. I mean, I just say, adelante, you know, always forward. And because we'll all be better off if you dedicate yourself to that and you make a career out of it. You'll make life better for all of us. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you both. That was great. And thank you for these wonderful questions tonight, too. It was really a terrific program. I do a lot of them, and I'm really, like, blown away by this one. So thank you. And Hector will be signing in the lobby. And then please join us to celebrate his book in the terrace. We will be having a reception. So please come. And see you next time. Thank you both.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.